This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The Gulf of Maine is warming faster than 99% of the world's oceans. We have a very significant problem here relating to kind of microclimate conditions.
Last week on Sea Change Radio, we spoke with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Bob Marshall about Louisiana's shrinking coastline. And this week we continue to talk about coastlines. First, in the second part of our discussion with Bob Marshall, we focus on the massive undertaking of reversing a century and a half of policies that have left the Mississippi River Delta region battered. He'll tell us about the struggle to raise funds and political will in a part of the country where oil and gas are king. Then, from the deep south, we go down east to talk with former Maine State Representative Seth Berry about his state's coastal problems. Ocean acidification and rising sea temperatures are putting much of Maine's fishing economy at risk. Like Louisiana, Maine has a Republican governor who has been throwing up obstacles for environmental groups who are trying to address the issue. Berry discusses what it will take to win the battle against the governor Politico dubbed America's Craziest. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Pulitzer Prize-winning environmental journalist Bob Marshall. He works for The Lens as an environmental journalist. Bob, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Bob, how are environmental groups and their allies working to get the oil and gas industry to pay if they won't do it out of their own self-interest?
Well, after Katrina, the legislature decided that the local levy authorities were inefficient and in many cases corrupt. So they created a regional levy authority, and it's called the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority, East, and it's one for the west side of the river as well. And the people who serve on this board don't get paid. They have to be qualified either as scientists or geologists or engineers or people representing business. And so this board, in August of 2013, decided that, looking at the research, understanding that the levees that they were expected to build, to maintain, the Corps just built $14.5 billion of properly built levees, but now it's up to this authority in the state to maintain those, and they know that's going to cost them about $14 million a year. And they know that the people in this area will support it with property taxes, but they can't keep raising those taxes. And so they looked at, going forward, what was the greatest threat to being able to maintain these levees and flood walls? Well, it was storm surge. And storm surge is predicted to get worse because the wetlands aren't there anymore. And why aren't the wetlands there? Well, one of the causes, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, at least 36% of the wetland loss is directly related to oil and gas activity. That research was done, 15 years ago, and since then there's been more research done by universities showing the direct and indirect impacts of the oil and gas industry is responsible for 60% of the total wetlands loss in this area. And this is not one report. There's probably 50 or 60 pieces of research backing this up. So this board said, well, hey, you were permitted. The state gave you permits to dredge these canals. But the permits said that when you were finished, you had to return the areas you were in pretty much the way they were. You had to fill in these canals and repair any marsh that you damaged. And they didn't do that. And so they had one of the governor's coastal folks.
When you say they, is that the board?
The board. The board had approached the governor's top assistant for the coast, and they said, look, we're thinking of filing suit because we're not going to have the money to maintain these levees. would you talk to the oil and gas industry? And, you know, it's in their own self-interest if they want to sit down at the table and say, and talk to us about a solution. And he came back to them and said, they're not ready to do that yet. And so they did file this suit. And, of course, that set off a political firestorm. The governor, who's a conservative Republican and doesn't like environmental lawsuits of any time, he's not sure about global warming science. He doesn't think evolution is really the thing to teach in school, at least not without creationism, and on and on.
He doesn't like libraries too much either. I saw that he choked funding to public libraries in Louisiana. That's why I mentioned that.
Well, he's cut higher education already. I think about, I don't know, $700 million. But at any rate, and he's an Ivy League graduate and a Rhodes Scholar. But at any rate, so the governor said, this isn't going to happen. I'll pass a law to kill this suit. And in the meantime, I'll try to stack the board with people who promised me they're against the lawsuit. But, you know, as John Barry, you mentioned John Barry, the author of Rising Tide, who lives here in New Orleans and has for many years. He's between here and D.C., and he's on this board, the vice president.
This is the levy board before Bobby Jindal could put his own cronies on there. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And so John was vice president of this board, and it really helped lead this suit. And it, by the way, the board voted unanimously to file the suit. And so he said many times, look, this is not just about us, it's about the whole state. Why don't we sit down in the oil and gas industry? Why don't you tell the legislature you'll support an increase in excise taxes that the oil and gas company pays for everything shipped through Louisiana? And we'll give you immunity from future suits. I mean, it seemed to be, you know, like a win-win, right? Because they would then have a permanent funding source for the master plan. They could be rebuilding these wetlands and levees to protect all this oil and gas infrastructure, not to mention the 2 million people who live in this area. So it would be a win-win. And guess what? If that meant that the price of oil went up, it would just be passed on to their consumers all over the country. And guess what? They have a stake in this as well. So it seemed like a logical thing to them. They knew there'd be some political pushback, but they had no idea just how vociferous the then head of the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, Garrett Graves, who's now a freshman congressman, and the governor would be in fighting this. So the legislature did pass one bill. There are many people who work in oil and gas who also serve in the legislature. I think a dozen bills were filed to kill the suit. Only one made it out. And it retroactively removed the authority of this levy board to file a suit. That's now in federal court. Meanwhile, since then, a state judge, district judge, has ruled the law unconstitutional. And the oil companies, after the suit was filed, filed the petition to move it to federal court since it does involve some federal regulations. And that's where this thing is now. They're waiting for the state Supreme Court to rule on the lower court judge's decisions. And a federal judge is waiting to render her decision on whether or not the law is constitutional. We hope to get some answer from her in February this month. So if that suit, most people believe if it passes these procedural questions and if it doesn't pass constitutional muster and the suit gets to court, the oil and gas industry will definitely have to settle because it's pretty clear that they did not abide by the terms of their permits. But that's still up in the air.
Played it on the audio. Anything I know. To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to environmental journalist Bob Marshall. Let's put aside fiscal concerns for a second and just say that we had a blank check to do this. Just from a physical standpoint, is there agreement from an environmental standpoint? What would be the best way to save this coastline?
Well, I'm just a journalist, and everything I know about this comes from interviewing the people as far as the fixes go. And the master plan was put together by not just Louisiana's coastal scientists, who are among the best in the world, but with help from national and international experts. It's a very long and rigorous process, and the conclusions that I would have to say make the most sense are the ones in the master plan, and that is trying to get this sediment and fresh water from the river back into these basins. If you can consider, you know, everything outside the river, all these wetlands, and by the way, probably 80% of what you see on the map of southeast Louisiana is wetlands right now. You know, there's only very thin strips of dry land. So, you know, the best way to keep these from turning to open water is to move that sediment back into these sinking basins. If you think of the river as the basins, all the wetlands around the river as, you know, a patient with cancer, and then the river, the great thing about our situation is that the river has a sediment. There's the chemo is in the river, and all we have to do is get it out there to these patients with cancer. But as simple as that sounds, the engineering trying to mimic nature's system of building deltas, that's never been done before.
And it's probably compounded by the geological faults in the region we haven't discussed as well, right?
Yes. There are faults in the delta itself and in the hard rock below. But, you know, the big problem is basically keeping these things from going underwater and sinking too quickly. Because eventually, and some of them already have, they'll become too deep and too wide because there's a limited supply of sediment in the river. And the river has other jobs to do. You have to keep enough water in the river for shipping. So there's so many challenges. For example, on a sediment diversion, trying to decide, first of all, where would you build it? Well, you have to build it somewhere where the diversion would catch enough sediment and water from the river's when it gets high so it can put it into these wetlands. And that isn't on every mile of the river south of New Orleans. That's at specific spots where the current will take enough of this, carry enough fresh water and sediment to make it worthwhile. Okay, so maybe you find that spot. But then it has to be close to one of the basins that isn't already too deep enough and too wide enough that you'd just be, you know, pouring sand into the ocean, more or less. So is this next to a basin that still has enough of its old infrastructure of ridges and patches of marsh that it could catch this sediment and rebuild land? Okay, so that's the second thing you have to figure out. Then you have to figure out, well, wait a minute, what would be the human impact? Are there communities around these basins that might flood if we put too much water in there during a high tide? Well, how would we protect them? Well, we have to build them higher levees, and how much is that going to cost?
We haven't even talked about how New Orleans is really not that far from this. It's right in the heart of this area that we're discussing. This is a major metropolitan area.
Yes, it's protected by levees. Finally, good levees, most of the city. So, you know, it's a real juggling act. It's a chess match, really, with nature and with these variables that are changing, and no one can really predict. No one can really predict what subsidence will do going forward. And even more importantly, no one really knows just how severe sea level rise will be. So that's why this plan is adaptable. What the smartest thing they did when they passed the law creating the master plan is that they want it to be renewed and resubmitted to the legislature every 5 years, because this is such a dynamic, meaning changing landscape, and the science is evolving. But even more importantly, the politicians, the legislature, can only vote the plan up or down. They can't go in and amend it. So the scientists and engineers with public input come up with the revised plan every 5 years based on what they've learned, and they send it to Baton Rouge, and the politicians can either go up or down. So far, the two times we've done this, they've approved it unanimously. So there is some pushback. Some fishermen, mostly commercial fishermen, some sport fishermen, don't want diversions because some commercial and sports fishermen, fishing guides, are fighting the diversions because they would change the salinity in these bays from the brackish to salt that it's devolved into since the 30s back to fresh, and that would displace some of their target species. They only want these slurry pipelines dredging the sand from the river and pumping it into these basins, and that wouldn't necessarily change the salinity. So they're against it, but they're about the only ones really against this.
So in terms of immediate next steps, Bob, where do you see things moving forward in order to somehow turn Louisiana's shrinking coastline around?
Well, because of some of the BP penalty fines, the state is moving forward with some really important research on just what the river has to offer in terms of sediment and freshwater south of New Orleans along the coast, and what these projects could accomplish if they are built on time. That research is wrapping up this year, and by the end of this year, they'll have a no-go decision on some of these large diversions, sediment diversions. So, you know, there's some promise of more money coming from the Clean Water Act violations. BP's in court right now. So they are moving forward, and they're also looking for other ways for funding. They're doing research on carbon credits and wetlands and that kind of stuff. But the future is still very much uncertain because for many reasons. We called it Louisiana's moonshot, the second part of the series with ProPublica, because they really are boldly going, where no coastal scientists and engineers have ever gone. They're actually doing the science. They're kind of creating the science and the engineering as they go on the fly. And it's pretty exciting stuff because of what's at stake. You know, if this doesn't work, if they can't figure it out, if the computer simulations are wrong, then there'll be, you know, a million people moving, looking for new homes.
Well, it's a vibrant part of the country with wonderful people and some of the best flora and fauna in our nation. And so it's important work that you're doing, making people aware of this problem. Bob Marshall, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you for doing this.
We shall gather at the river with each other, 'cause you're my brother, and dip our souls, put in the water for the healing of each other. Saved and sanctified, freed from sin to where freedom lies, and fly away over land because we can, because we can.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
Well, while we're talking about coastlines, we were just talking about Louisiana's shrinking coastline with journalist Bob Marshall. I wanted to introduce
Back to the show. Former state representative and House Majority Leader in the Maine legislature. He's currently a vice president of Kennebec River Biosciences. My friend Seth Berry. Welcome back to Sea Change Radio, Seth.
Hey, great to be with you, Alex.
People think of Maine as one of the more pristine parts of our country, and it is a wonderful, beautiful place, but it's suffering not just on its coast, but right off the coast as well. Why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch of the problem of ocean acidification in your region, Seth?
Sure. Well, you're absolutely right. You know, one of Maine's hallmarks is its pristine waters. You know, the Gulf of Maine is a really unique ecosystem. This huge basin that's just off of the Gulf Stream, so we get a confluence of warm and cold waters. Great for all kinds of aquatic life, and this huge basin that's really rich in marine life just off of our shore. So, you know, the Gulf of Maine is the reason that we have such an amazing, such a famous lobster fishery here. Oysters, clams, cod has always been big. And the reason Cape Cod, of course, is called Cape Cod is because of the cod fishery, which Maine fishermen have been big participants in. So it's very vital to our heritage. And Maine's waterfront, of course, for those that aren't familiar with it, is just spotted with islands and peninsulas, very rocky inlets and outlets, almost like the fjords of Norway in some respects, because of the way the glaciers carved it. We're a New England state, so obviously not huge, but big by New England standards. And we have over 3,500 miles of coastline, maybe 5,000, depending on how you measure it. So very, very rich marine life and marine economy. The problem that we're facing now is really twofold. It's warming on the one hand, and it's acidification on the other. And of course, the two are related. We're all familiar with climate change. Some folks are less aware of the problem of acidification. And that has to do with the absorption by the oceans of carbon as more carbon dioxide is present in our environment. And as that absorption happens, it makes the ocean slightly more acidic, and specifically the surface of the ocean. The very deep ocean is relatively unaffected, but it's the surface that matters for most forms of life because they're dependent on the solar light up near the top. So the two together represent a very significant threat to our famous waters here and the economy that depends on them.
From somebody who's served in Maine's legislature for 8 years, I believe,
yep.
Take us inside the battle that's brewing right now. There's a study underway, a state commission to study the impact of ocean acidification on shellfish, but it's not so simple as just a study. There's politics involved. Why don't you give us an insider's view on the political process here and why somebody would maybe have a problem with learning more about ocean acidification?
Sure. Well, you know, the ocean acidification issue was raised by a Democratic colleague of mine, a member of my caucus, when I was House Majority Leader, a new representative by the name of Mick Devon. And he did a great job as sponsor, took it very seriously. And he actually happens to be a marine biologist himself. So he was a logical person to have seen this issue as a serious one and have brought it to the fore. He was the House chair of the commission, which ultimately was formed through legislation. And they took a look at the question of ocean acidification. Was it a serious threat to Maine's economy? And ultimately, the entire panel, which had several meetings and looked at all the research and data, came up with a very clear decision that this is an enormous threat to our economy and our way of life here in Maine. The acidifying waters can prevent shellfish from forming their shells, especially in the early stages of development. We've seen, for example, in the softshell clam industry here, a lot of clam diggers out there on the coast. They're not getting the clams that they used to, nowhere near. And they've blamed, by and large, a huge proliferation of green crabs for that. Now, green crabs are a species that eats the softshell clams, and especially when they are younger and more vulnerable, their shells haven't fully formed. And it's possible, not certain by any means, but it's possible that the green crab explosion, population explosion, has had to do with that issue of clams early on, juvenile clams having trouble forming their shells as firmly and protectively as they used to. So that's just one small example. But oysters, same deal. Lobsters are threatened. They have to put on shell as well, and any of those species. But, you know, acidification raises all kinds of questions, too, about plant life and plankton and what species will thrive in a more acidic environment. And there are so many unknowns. And that was also one of the things that the commission decided, was that this absolutely requires a lot more research, a lot more study. We need to put some real financial muscle into it and be willing to pay for that research to happen. You know, we have some good infrastructure, water monitoring buoys, very sophisticated, some nonprofits that do great work, like the Gulf of Maine Research Institute and the university here, but more is needed. So that was another piece.
So what are some of the steps that the Maine legislature could take? What do you expect some of the recommendations would be? I know that a lot of the pollution is absorbed by the ocean, but nitrogen pollution can intensify things. So like a lot of runoff from streets and fertilized lawns, sewage issues, things like that. Is that where they're going to try to first tackle it? Where's the low-hanging fruit to solve this problem, Seth?
So it's definitely a multifaceted solution, and we have to look at both prevention and also adaptation. You know, we need to mitigate and prevent, but we also need to find ways to adapt to a changing reality, because this is something that's obviously a global phenomenon, and our actions here need to be actions of leaders, you know, of folks who take the problem seriously. But we also need to recognize that, you know, the shoreline is receding. You know, the oceans are acidifying and they all are warming. So we need to advance science as well that supports adaptation. So it is a question of public will to make the investments needed for that research. R&D generally has been very undervalued by our current governor. He's several times vetoed important R&D proposals that were bipartisan, coming from legislators on both sides of the aisle. You know, he was recently referred to by the blog Climate Progress as being one of the most climate denying governors in the country, and I think that's fairly accurate. You know, his policies have certainly not helped. Warming is another issue that I really haven't even covered, but the Gulf of Maine is warming faster than 99% of the world's oceans. We have a very significant problem here relating to kind of microclimate conditions and our location with respect to the Gulf of Maine. So we're in the top 1% of warming, roughly a tenfold increase in the rate of warming over the last two or three decades. So very significant problem as well, and we need to worry about that. Lobster shell disease may be on the rise because of it. A lot of our fisheries are moving north on us, and so that too is something where we need to both adapt and prevent. And unfortunately, this governor has really proposed a lot of policies that would take us backwards with respect to things like renewable energy and energy efficiency, you know, and just generally taking climate change seriously.
Former state representative and the VP of Kennebec River Biosciences, Seth Berry. Seth, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Keep up the good work.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Herbie Hancock, Rusty Kershaw, and Develle Crawford. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.